This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, September 29th, 2009. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Comp, sitting in for Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, Tropical Storm Ketsana affects some 2 million people in the Philippines. More than 230 have died. On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers push for a public option in the health care reform bill. And we go to Argentina, where a strike at a Kraft Foods factory has sparked mass firings and street protests. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Hospital corridors in the capital of Guinea remain filled with wounded demonstrators today after military forces opened fire yesterday on a peaceful pro-democracy rally. More than 150 were killed and some 1,200 injured, according to local human rights observers. Some were stabbed with bayonets and knives. Hundreds of women were sexually assaulted. Some 50,000 people demonstrating against current leader Captain Musa Dadis Camara defied a ban on public protests and marched to a stadium in Conakry. After ordering them to disperse, the military opened fire. France severed its military ties with Guinea today, and the African Union has threatened sanctions. In Honduras, de facto President Micheletti backpedaled, saying he would consider reversing the presidential decree that suspended some constitutional rights in the Central American nation. Tim Russo reports from Tegucigalpa.
Monday, members of the Honduran Congress argued that a presidential decree suspending civil liberties would expire only 2 weeks before proposed November 29th elections, making it impossible to campaign. After a request from Congress to repeal the decree that limits the freedom to gather or travel and gives the military and police authority to arrest people with no warrants, de facto President Micheletti apologized in a press conference for having implemented the decree and stated,
"Y por eso nosotros vamos a tomar una determinación la más correcta posible.
We will determine the best possible thing for the interests of the country, but it will be in a meeting of the Council of Ministers, and that is where the decree will be recalled if necessary."
Que va a derogar el decreto si es necesario.
Deposed President Zelaya bashed the decree in a phone call from the Brazilian embassy to the United Nations. In an emergency meeting of the OAS, W. Louis Amsalem, the U.S. ambassador to the OAS, called Zelaya, quote, irresponsible and foolish for returning to Honduras. Widespread international condemnation of media censorship in Honduras has abounded after the closings of two stations with anti-coup stances. The Committee for the Protection of Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, and the International Federation of Journalists were just three institutions that condemned the closures and the beatings of a Guatemalan, Mexican, and Honduran journalist on Monday. Tim Russo, FSRN, Tegucigalpa.
Najibullah Zazi appeared in a Brooklyn court today and pleaded not guilty to charges of conspiracy to commit terrorism. Authorities claim that Mr. Zazi planned to detonate an explosive device in New York this past September 11th. Prosecutors said today that evidence collected against Zazi was done so under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. He was ordered held without bail. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, took unprecedented steps today to keep its cash flow positive, calling on banks to prepay assessments that were previously due over the next 3 years. The government-run agency insures individual deposits in member banks in the event a bank fails. FDIC staff member Diane Ellis explains why the FDIC needs an infusion of cash.
The problem we are facing is one of timing. Losses are occurring in the near term, and revenue will be spread out into future years. Now, the loss projections are subject to some uncertainty, and actual losses could be higher or lower. This projection of failure costs is higher than our projection in May of $70 billion over the same time period due to the further deterioration in the condition of insured institutions, as reflected primarily by the increasing number of problem institutions. Nevertheless, based on these projections, we estimate the fund balance will be negative as of September 30, 2009, due to an increase in provisions for anticipated failures.
The fund balance is projected to be in the red tomorrow, but FDIC staff say that doesn't mean they'll be out of cash that soon. Chairperson Sheila Blair says that the agency has tons of money and assets to continue to protect depositors in the event of another bank failure in the near term. 95 banks have failed thus far in 2009. The idea behind requiring the prepayments is to make sure that the banking industry continues to shoulder the financial responsibility of funding its insurance and to prevent a misconception that the federal government is providing any more aid to banks. The requirement could become official after a 30-day public comment period. Unpiloted aircraft dropped missiles in two separate attacks today in the Waziristan region of northwest Pakistan. Local officials claim that 9 fighters were killed. Civilians in the region continue to flee after both the government and the Taliban urged them to seek safety elsewhere ahead of an anticipated major offensive in the area. And in Afghanistan, 30 civilians were killed and 39 wounded by a roadside bomb today. They were passengers on a bus that was traveling from Nimrud to Kandahar when it was detoured by a NATO work group clearing the roadside and encountered the bomb. The explosion killed 10 children, 7 women, and 13 men. Also today, at a meeting with President Obama, NATO head Anders Fogh Rasmussen promised that the NATO military alliance will accomplish its mission in Afghanistan. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
In their fifth day of public deliberations, the Senate Finance Committee is debating the so-called public option. The provision isn't included in their version of the bill, but some Democrats hope it's added. Meanwhile, filmmaker Michael Moore has descended on Washington and vowed to defeat any Democrat who doesn't support universal health care. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Senate Finance Committee defeated two attempts to add the public option to the bill. Democratic Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia said health insurance companies are bound to be swimming in profits if this bill were enacted. He cites a mandate that people buy into the health insurance program, potentially giving them 47 million new customers.
Really, it's sort of a question of why would we not do this? Because if we don't do it, what we're doing is saying, go ahead, health insurance companies, and make more profits. That's the result.
This blunt assessment is common on Capitol Hill, but usually when it's directed at members of the other party. Senator Rockefeller was criticizing a bill written by his Democratic colleague, Chair of the Finance Committee, Max Baucus of Montana. Senator Baucus was forced to defend his bill. He said insurance companies would have to release their expenditures and will have to pay an excise tax. Baucus also points to a measure that would require competitive bidding for Medicare Advantage, which he says is expected to cost the insurance companies $100 billion in profits over 10 years.
This bill does not, that does hold insurance companies feet to the fire.
Supporters for the government-run public option stressed that it will only be an option for consumers. Senator Rockefeller said it will save the government $50 billion over 10 years. But the measure failed. 5 Democrats sided with all the Republicans to defeat it. They include Senators Max Baucus, Blanche Lincoln, Bill Nelson, Tom Carper, and Kent Conrad. The committee also debated an amendment by Senator Charles Schumer of New York, which will enable the government to negotiate its rates in a public option. It's different than Senator Rockefeller's because his tied reimbursement rates to Medicare. 3 Democrats supported the Republicans to defeat Senator Schumer's version as well, even though it was more beneficial to the insurance companies. Meanwhile, filmmaker Michael Moore was in Washington to promote his new movie Capitalism, A Love Story. He joined a news conference on healthcare, where he promised to use his resources and his following to defeat any Democrat who does not support a public option.
I, and a lot of other people, have every intention of removing you from Congress in the next election if you stand in the way of healthcare legislation that the people want. That is not a hollow or idle threat. We will come to your districts, and we will work against you.
Michael Moore, who made the movie Sicko, says a single-payer option where Medicare would be expanded to cover anyone is optimal. But he laid down his requirements for any legislation.
We reject any bill that doesn't have, at the minimum, the public option available to all people who can buy into this. If it's just what we're seeing, this mandated health insurance, which means a billions of dollars more in free cash to the private health insurance companies, we reject that out of hand. We do not support it. We will never compromise to that position.
He also criticized President Obama for striking deals between the health insurance companies, the hospitals, and the pharmaceuticals.
Anybody who's bought a car, anybody who's bought or sold their house or negotiated anything knows you don't start with your final position. You don't start with the compromise. You start with everything that you want, everything that you believe in.
Doctors in support of single payer will rally in D.C. beginning tomorrow. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
New census data shows that Texas has the largest uninsured population in the country, with one in four residents living without health care coverage. Texas is also home to the world's largest medical center, a sprawling campus of 47 different health-related institutions, from state-of-the-art hospitals and research institutes to nursing and medical schools. For this edition of Street Beat, reporter Shannon Young went to the Texas Medical Center in Houston to ask healthcare professionals and medical students their personal opinions about what lawmakers should prioritize in healthcare reform.
I'm Tyler Murray, and I'm opposed to a government-run healthcare option because I think that's a Trojan horse for single-payer healthcare.
Are you a medical student?
Yeah, I'm a medical student. I'm a first-year medical student.
Angelo Giardino, and I'm a pediatrician. Use what's successful, like CHIP and Medicaid, and take care of the kids first.
Claudia Gonzaga, and I'm a graduate student, biomedical sciences. It should be easier for people to get medical attention whenever they need it, and also affordable.
I'm Dr. Abdullah. I'm observing in psychiatric unit. I think free healthcare for all, and not just insured patient. I think the government has to put a lot of tax on this, but it has to provide a good health to the whole people.
My name is Urban Chua. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Baylor College of Medicine. My recommendation would be just simple, a public option for people to have the health care. I think that in this country, everyone should be able to have health care insurance.
My name is Michael Bungo. I'm a physician here at the University of Texas Health Sciences Center, a professor of medicine and cardiology.
And if you can make one recommendation to lawmakers regarding health care reform, what would it be?
It's obviously very difficult to make one recommendation, so the most encompassing thing I can say is to adopt the Baucus plan. I think that, in short, most of what we need in healthcare reform, with perhaps the exception of some tort reform, and of course the major question of how to fund it, is included in that proposal.
I'm a doctor. I don't want to give my name. And I think that health insurance premiums is a topic to be debated. They should be lowered, and that would bring prices down.
My name is Don LaSeuss, and I'm a fourth-year medical student at Baylor College of Medicine. And so one suggestion to lawmakers, first of all, would be to have as a priority to actually cover the uninsured and not be so concerned about catering to those who already have health insurance. Quite honestly, from my perspective, I think that we need to move towards a single-payer healthcare system in order to truly contain costs and cover everybody in the United States.
I am a research scientist at Texas Heart Institute. My name is Maria Cabrera. And healthcare for every American, please.
Reporter Shannon Young recorded this edition of Street Beat at the Texas Medical Center in Houston. You're listening to FSRN. A Kraft Foods factory has reopened in Argentina after workers shut it down for more than a month to protest massive layoffs and anti-union measures. The Illinois-based corporation denies it was trying to break up unions. And last week, it obtained a court order to dislodge more than 60 workers who were blocking operations at the factory. The incident sparked street demonstrations yesterday and a response from the U.S. Embassy. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports.
Kraft Foods fired 160 workers in August after a series of strikes to demand proper health measures at the company's factory in suburban Buenos Aires. Workers then seized the plant and carried out a 40-day work stoppage, with many of the 2,500 workers participating in the strike action. The U.S. company has accused protesting workers of prohibiting personnel from entering the plant, but the union says that they were camping inside the plant specifically to demand their jobs. Earlier this month, union representatives reported that managers interrogated workers in the presence of police and without their labor lawyers present. Following failed negotiations late on Friday, police surrounded the plant and attacked protesters, arresting 60 people and injuring 12. Fernando Sanchez is one of the fired workers who occupied the plant.
Kraft is a North American multinational that has the money to finance repression and pay fines to the labor ministry when they violate Argentina's labor laws. The company wants to implement 12-hour shifts, but they need to cut personnel. But first, they had to remove all of the organized labor inside the plant, our elected union delegates and internal commission at the factory.
Kraft's plant in Argentina is the nation's second-largest food processing center, and the company is the second-largest food manufacturer in the world. Human rights lawyer Maria del Carmen Verdú says Kraft is in violation of Argentina's criminal code because it used the plant as a detention center.
Prisoners, instead of being taken to the police stations, they were detained inside the factory in an unprecedented circumstance where lawyers couldn't even enter the place where the prisoners were being detained. The repression at the plant was ordered by the government to defend the interests of a North American company.
On Monday, Kraft announced 100 more suspensions of workers who participated in the strike action. Following a massive march on Monday in Argentina's capital, where thousands demanded the rehiring of the workers, Kraft agreed to revise on a case-by-case basis each of the firings. The U.S. Embassy has not intervened, but said in a statement, quote, "The embassy has been following the conflict based on our interest in promoting U.S. investment in Argentina." Another fired worker, Liliana Nivera, criticized the government's position at the recent G20 summit in Pittsburgh, mentioning a photo of the U.S. and Argentine presidents hugging. Kraft was a premier contributor to the Barack Obama's electoral campaign.
Where is the president? Where has she been? While we were being repressed, treated like criminals for defending our jobs, Cristina Kirchner was sitting and hugging the owners of the factory who were responsible for the repression.
Kraft has reported record revenues in 2008, making nearly $42 billion in revenue. The multinational reports that its Argentine plant is back to producing, while protests and road blockades are ongoing throughout the country. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
For nearly a decade, FSRN has brought you news from more than 200 reporters across six continents.
In the jungle province of Chocó,
workers at SK Hand Tools in Chicago
say, yes, I can give you specific figures.
Thousands prepared to take to the streets once again.
At a time when newspapers are downsizing and closing their international bureaus, FSRN continues to bring you on-the-ground and in-depth coverage from global hotspots like the Gaza Strip and the tribal belt of Pakistan. You hear the voices of everyday people sharing their challenges and struggles, their resourcefulness and determination.
This needed to really be a call to action.
Iran deserves to have a democracy. We will get closer to that goal.
And we're making our stand here.
That's how I feel exactly, you see.
Reporting that's critical in understanding how policymakers affect citizens at home and abroad. Your support of FSRN goes a long way in building and strengthening our international coverage. Visit fsrn.org to learn more about how you can help.
The death toll caused by Tropical Storm Ketsana in the Philippines has risen to more than 230 people, according to the National Disaster Coordinating Council. The tropical storm, also known as Typhoon Ondoy, swept through the northern Philippines on Saturday, pouring more than a month's worth of rain on Manila in less than 12 hours. Flooding has forced people to sleep in schools and gymnasiums across the capital city. During the day, thousands line up for food at disaster relief centers, including one that was set up on the grounds of the presidential palace. We're on the line now with Alex Mahoney. He's the disaster manager for Asia at the American Red Cross. Typhoons are a common occurrence in the Philippines and other Southeast Asian countries, and they often cause flooding. How was the Ketsana storm different from previous typhoons?
Well, as you said, it is a common occurrence. I think what makes this one particularly bad is that it came after a period where there already had been heavy rainfall. The ground was already pretty much saturated, which meant that flooding occurred very, very quickly.
Now, the government says the death toll has surpassed 230 people, but what about the survivors? How many people have been affected by this storm, and what conditions are they living in?
Well, at the moment, there are over 374,000 people who are displaced in evacuation centers, in more than 600 evacuation centers, 130 of those of which are run by the Red Cross. Beyond that, there are another 230,000 approximately people displaced in other locations, such as friends and families' homes. So all of these folks, of course, are living under very difficult conditions. The key right now is to make sure they get adequate food, water, and other immediate relief to help them through the next few days. And the Philippine Red Cross has been very involved in all of that.
What sort of relief efforts is your organization organizing? What are the most urgent necessities for people affected by a storm like this one?
We're still working on where our support is most needed. We have the ability to send technical specialists if needed. We have warehouses in the region that can provide things like blankets and hygiene kits. And we also have the ability to send financial support. So right now we're working to determine what the most critical needs are, where American Red Cross can make the biggest difference. And all of this we'll be updating on our website, which is redcross.org.
That was Alex Mahoney from the American Red Cross speaking about the humanitarian crisis in the Philippines. And now we go to the Bekasi Peninsula on the Cameroon-Nigeria border. Both countries have decided to share the region's oil resources after settling a century-old border dispute that gave the land to Cameroon. But the deal has made life difficult for Nigerian fishermen who were recently relocated and for people still living in the peninsula. FSRN's Sam Olakoya has the story.
57-year-old Achibong Edem was a fisherman his whole life, but now is asked to be a farmer and make his livelihood from the land. Achibong is among 100,000 Nigerian fishermen who left Bekasi Peninsula last year, when it was handed over to Cameroon. Before August 2008, when Nigeria formally transferred Bekasi Peninsula to Cameroon, about 300,000 people inhabited the region. 90% of the population was Nigerians, and they feared repression under the new Cameroonian rule. So the Nigerian government promised resettlement, and one-third of them were relocated to 30 kilometers inland, a dry farmland called Akpabuyo. I met Achibong Edem tilling his land.
I'm starting my life all over. I've left my livelihood, which is fishing, to come and stay here where there is no fishing port and no river to fish. In fact, it's exactly like removing a fish from a river to upland. That's how I feel exactly. You see, the fish removed from water, you know, putting it up land cannot breathe. So as such, leaving what you have been doing for survival to, indulge into something new in their life is, in fact, I cannot just express it.
Fish
all my life. 40 years ago, I've been fishing.
Life is equally difficult for Bakassi people who chose not to relocate to Nigeria. About 170,000 stayed back, and now they are angry to find both governments coming together to explore oil. For years, Cameroon and Nigeria were fighting over the Bakassi Peninsula, and now Nigeria is helping Cameroon to explore oil. Some sources close to the Nigerian government, who didn't want to be named, told this reporter that Nigeria agreed to hand over the Bakassi Peninsula to Cameroon only when it secured a guarantee from Cameroon that both countries will cooperate to explore oil in the peninsula. Estimates say oil from Bakassi could double Cameroon's current output of 85,000 barrels per day. Eric Essien, a Bakassi fisherman, says both countries are only interested in the crude oil in the region and not the welfare of the people.
In the Bakassi issue, is about two countries interested in the resources of the place, and they are not interested in the people. On the other side, the people are being still marginalized. They don't go to fishing as they used to again, because the fish are no longer there in the water as it used to be, you know, because of the exploitation going on in their waters. All the major international companies are in Bakassi water, drilling.
The Nigerians in the Bakassi region do not find life that easy under the new Cameroonian rule. Human rights reports document harassment from the Cameroonian police, and more people may choose for resettlement if the Nigerian government can ensure basic facilities and means for livelihood. Fidelis Ugbo is the head of the Nigerian government resettlement program for the Bakassi people. He says resettlement will take time.
Resettlement is not a once and for all thing. After the handover, it will take quite a long time before you can properly resettle the people, because it's not just putting them in homes. You will need to provide some kind of means of livelihood. Some of them who were fishermen, and you have to turn them from being fishermen to being traders. You need to do something. You need to organize a microcredit scheme which will take care of their needs. So it's not a thing that you can accomplish in 1 year, in 2 years.
The displaced Bakassi people say they do not understand why they were relocated in such hurry while nothing was put in place in Akpabuyo, their new home. And back in Adam Smith's farm, he struggles to cope as a farmer. He says every bit of him is a fisherman and wishes there was a water body around. The government once promised that it will get a marine environment, taking advantage of Akpabuyo's proximity to the Atlantic Ocean. But now it says it is impossible because the place is too marshy and the plan will cost millions of dollars. Meanwhile, in the Bakassi waters, multinational oil companies like ExxonMobil, Total, and Adax, along with the Cameroonian state-owned oil company SNH, are carrying out oil exploration. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Bakassi.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kamp.